Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents MarketCraft, How Governments Make Markets Work, by Stephen K. Vogel, narrated by Ryan Burke. 1. The MarketCraft Thesis. Markets need rules not only to protect people and the environment from collateral damage, but also to function effectively in the first place. Our real-world choices therefore hinge not on whether markets should be governed, but on how they should be governed. Consider the corporation, the institution at the heart of modern capitalism. There is nothing natural about it. The corporation is a construct that is granted legal identity, governing authority, and limited liability by the law. Or consider the stock market, the ultimate embodiment of capitalist ethos. It is likewise neither free nor natural, but rather elaborately governed. Stock markets require trading rules not only to prevent abuses, but also simply to operate. And they need more extensive rules, such as corporate disclosure requirements and insider trading restrictions, to flourish and to grow. The following chapters review these and other examples in greater detail, demonstrating how and why governments make markets work. But first, this chapter outlines the core thesis of the book. The argument begins with the basic recognition that real-world markets are institutions, humanly devised constraints that shape human interaction. There is no controversy on this point in its most stripped-down form. Yet scholars differ fundamentally in how they understand market institutions. Market liberals acknowledge that markets require some minimal rules of the game. The government must create the basic infrastructure for a modern economy by enforcing the rule of law, protecting private property, and maintaining a monetary system. Beyond that, however, they argue that the government should not intervene in market affairs. Other scholars have increasingly stressed that market systems are governed by a far more extensive web of institutions. Institutional economists, for example, view transaction costs, such as the costs of obtaining information or enforcing contracts, as the friction in the market system, and property rights as the means to reduce these costs. They move beyond the basic legal and financial infrastructure to study institutions such as business groups and labor contracts. Economic sociologists define market institutions even more broadly, including social networks and cultural norms. They stress that markets are always embedded in society. In this book, I contend that a more expansive definition of market institutions is not simply more accurate, but that it is a prerequisite for informed policymaking and analysis of real-world markets. I am certainly not the first one to pursue this line of argument. In fact, a market institutional perspective on political economy has emerged as a virtual consensus among policymakers and across social science disciplines when applied to markets everywhere except in the advanced industrial countries. Scholars have come to recognize that modern market systems are not natural phenomena that spontaneously arise, but rather complex institutions that must be created and sustained by the visible hand of the government. They make this same basic point with reference to three types of market transition: the historical transition from feudalism to market society in the West, the more recent transition from communism to capitalism in Eastern Europe and East Asia, and the ongoing struggle to create viable market systems in many developing countries. Yet, for the most part, scholars have failed to apply this same logic to the subtler transition toward more competitive and more sophisticated market systems in the advanced industrial countries. If markets are institutions, however, then market reform should be more a process of building institutions than one of removing constraints, and this should be no less true for more developed market systems than for less developed ones. Ironically, this point is less obvious for advanced industrial countries because they already have fairly well-developed market institutions. This book explores why viewing markets as institutions, complex combinations of laws, practices, and norms, is essential to understanding recent developments in advanced economies such as the United States and Japan. Moreover, while some scholars stress that modern markets require effective governance, Many policymakers, journalists, and pundits in the advanced economies continue to pretend that they do not. They speak and act as if there was such a thing as a free market that thrives without governance. They frame economic debates in terms of the false dichotomy of government versus market. The very language of economic debates, such as the common juxtaposition of government intervention versus market freedom, betrays these assumptions, and this conceptual confusion can beget some rather serious policy errors, as demonstrated in the chapters to follow. In this book, I seek to advance the conversation in three ways. First, I specify how conventional framing, such as the government's versus markets dichotomy, hampers public debate, policy prescription, and scholarly analysis, and I offer some modest suggestions for how to deploy more precise language, enhance conceptual clarity, and refine analysis. Second, I push the logic of the argument further to show how the rather banal assertion that markets are institutions leads logically to some far less obvious propositions, as outlined in the following section. Finally, in the concluding chapter, I demonstrate how even the most sophisticated analyst of market institutions sometimes fail to appreciate the full ramifications of their own arguments. They fall into the same linguistic traps as their intellectual adversaries, for example, or they fail to capture the extent to which market behavior is learned, not natural, and market operations are constructed, not free. And I conclude by demonstrating how conceptual misunderstandings can beget policy errors, and by specifying some lessons for both progressives and market liberals. This chapter presents the logical sequence of the argument, and the following three chapters explore real-world examples. The final chapter reviews the implications for various debates in the fields of rhetoric, economics, political science, sociology, political theory, and public policy. The core propositions. 1. There is no such thing as a free or perfect market. Conceptually, we can imagine the proverbial perfectly competitive market in which buyers and sellers would be seamlessly matched. Economists sometimes assume a perfect market for analytical purposes, and they have made important theoretical and empirical advances by building on such simplifying assumptions. But this perfect market does not exist, and it never has. Even primitive marketplaces were not free, in that they required some basic rules, such as locations or hours of operation. And the institutions underpinning exchange grew more complex as societies introduced credit and money. Douglas North illustrates this poignantly with his example of buying oranges from his favorite vendor. This simple exchange is governed by a personal relationship, market practices, and social norms, all underpinned by the rule of law. 2. Markets have to be created. If markets are institutions, then that means that people have to create them. As Karl Polanyi famously quipped, laissez-faire was planned. The architects of these institutions might be governments, firms, or individuals, and they might create markets deliberately or spontaneously, at one moment in time or over decades or centuries. I am partial to the language of crafting markets, as evidenced in the title of this volume, because it highlights the artistry required for effective market governance. It recognizes this as a core governmental function comparable to statecraft, and it applies to both government and private sector market governance. But this does not mean that governments always get it right. Just as real-world statecraft can be masterful or clumsy, beneficent or disastrous, so it is with marketcraft. 3. Market reform is primarily a constructive enterprise, not a destructive one. Here we begin to shift from rather banal observations to less obvious implications. Yet this proposition follows logically from the ones preceding it. If markets are institutions, then cultivating markets requires building institutions more than destroying them. In short, liberalizing the economy does not mean liberating it. This simple observation has profound implications for how we understand market reform and fundamentally challenges some of the most common perspectives on the important issues of our day. It demonstrates how a market institutional perspective begets both scholarly analysis and policy prescriptions that diverge markedly from the market liberal view. Market liberals have conceived of market reform as liberalization rather than institution building, and therefore have advocated removing barriers, privatization, and liberalization, more than building capabilities, market transition, and market development. Yet, as noted earlier, scholars have come to recognize that shifting from a planned economy to a market system requires building new institutions more than dismantling old ones. And promoting markets in developing countries requires cultivating the government's ability to sustain market institutions more than just getting overbearing governments out of the way. They have been slower to grasp the implications for the study of market reform in rich countries. Yet, even for developed economies, making markets more competitive and expanding them into new realms requires not simply removing regulations that impede competition, deregulation, but enhancing regulatory capacity and building market institutions, that is, market craft. 4. There is no single market solution to a policy challenge. If there is no such thing as a perfect market, then there is no single free market solution. Any market solution constitutes a particular form of market governance. Real-world market governance varies across many dimensions, not just government versus market, but also public versus private governance, laissez-faire versus pro-competitive regulation, and so on. So this means that there are multiple market solutions to any given challenge, reflecting different combinations of points along these various dimensions. Some market liberals might accept this proposition, yet insist that the crux of the issue still pits government intervention against market freedom. That is, the question is not whether markets have rules or not, but who sets them, the government or the market players. And the government imposes rules by force, whereas market players devise their rules voluntarily. Yet, I would counter that in practice the government must play the leading role in market design, for reasons discussed further in the following section. Moreover, the market liberal perspective underestimates the scale and scope of regulation necessary to make modern markets work, and overestimates the level of constraint imposed by government action and the degree of freedom allowed by the market. Reducing the government role would not necessarily unleash markets. In fact, it could just as well constrain market actors more, not less. For example, the government might compromise market freedom by failing to rein in private market power, or by withdrawing regulations that support markets. Chapter 5 returns to this issue of the relationship between government action and market freedom at greater length. 5. There may not even be a more free market, or a more market-oriented alternative among policy options. Even if there is no pure free market, market liberals might argue we should still posit it as an ideal, a target for policy reform. That is, we should seek to move toward the free market, for this would enhance both economic efficiency and personal liberty. Yet most policy choices are not about government versus market, but rather about how to govern markets. And if we compare two market designs, it is often not obvious which is more market-like or closer to a free market solution. In some cases, it may be possible to judge one option as more market-oriented than another. For example, imposing a tariff implies more government control and less market competition, so removing it could reasonably be viewed as a move toward a hypothetical free market. We should not be surprised that the market liberal worldview fits international trade better than most domestic market governance issues, for it is precisely the issue that motivated Smith and subsequent liberal economists. In most contemporary debates, however, the relevant choices align along dimensions that defy characterizations as more or less market-oriented. For example, there are complex trade-offs between adversarial versus discretionary styles of government regulation, or open versus closed bidding models for auctions. More fundamentally, it is often not obvious what would constitute a move toward the market. If we shift antitrust policy from a more laissez-faire approach to a more pro-competitive approach, then which is the more market-oriented solution? If we tighten rules over the fair use of copyrighted material, is that a move toward the free market or away from it? The effort to describe these choices in terms of government versus the free market obscures the real choices involved. They involve real trade-offs, but not ones of government versus market, and many contemporary debates take precisely this form, as discussed in Chapter 2. 6. The government versus market dichotomy that animates most debates about economic policy is fundamentally misleading. The assumption that there is a dichotomy between government and market impedes a more sophisticated understanding of this relationship. As we move from a thin definition of market institutions, the minimal rules of the game, to a thicker one, a broader range of laws, practices, and norms, the relationship between government and market becomes more complementary. 7. The regulation versus competition dichotomy that animates most debates about economic regulation is fundamentally misleading. The very language of deregulation belies this misperception. In conventional discourse, the term refers to less regulation and more competition, as if the two were naturally associated. In fact, generating more competition usually requires more regulation, not less. Thus, the dominant trend in advanced industrial countries over the past 40 years has not been one of deregulation, less regulation, but rather one of market reform, more competition, through re-regulation, more regulation. That is, freer markets and more rules. Deregulation in the literal sense of less regulation and more competition is possible, of course. Reducing or eliminating price and entry regulation, for example, should foster more competition. In practice, however, the relationship between regulation and competition tends to be more positive than negative. We can refine this point by noting that the relationship between regulation and competition varies across time and across sectors and subsectors. It may be more positive at an early stage of market development when the market has to create the basic infrastructure to support market competition, and more negative at a later stage, when an incremental increase in the government's role may be more likely to impede than to enhance competition. And it may be more positive in sectors that are more conducive to monopoly, such as network industries, and more negative in sectors where barriers to entry are low, such as retail. Several distinct mechanisms underlie the overall trend toward more regulation with more competition. First, as governments introduce competition in sectors characterized by natural monopoly, such as public utility sectors, they have to deploy pro-competitive regulation to create and sustain competition. Second, as financial markets become more competitive and more sophisticated, governments have to enhance regulation to support these markets, with stricter disclosure requirements, more elaborate trading rules, and more intensive supervision. Third, as product and service markets become more competitive, with a greater number of players, then regulation tends to become more codified and legalistic. Fourth, as transport and product markets become more competitive, governments need to strengthen environmental, health, and safety regulations. If truckers compete more fiercely, for example, governments have to strengthen safety regulation, such as limits on driving hours. In practice, market reform means increasing regulations that enhance competition, such as antitrust rules, and removing regulations that impede it, such as price and entry restrictions. And understanding this process requires carefully differentiating between the two. Despite the overall trend toward greater regulatory complexity, it may be possible to devise simpler regulatory solutions that are equally or more effective in some cases. In finance, for example, higher capital reserve requirements, the structural separation of commercial and investment banks, and a financial transaction tax represents simpler regulatory mechanisms that might reduce the need for some detailed behavioral rules and intensive supervision. 8. A liberal market economy, LME, like the United States, is just as governed as a coordinated market economy, CME, like Japan, possibly more. LMEs feature more competitive labor, financial, and product markets, whereas CMEs favor greater coordination among firms, banks, and other firms. Scholars of comparative capitalism tend to view LMEs as less institutionalized or less embedded than CMEs. But if markets are institutions, then all markets are governed by distinct combinations of laws, practices, and norms, so LMEs and CMEs are equally governed. Chapter 3 examines this proposition via a detailed case study of the United States, demonstrating how this freest of market economies relies on a massive infrastructure of market governance. One could even argue that a more liberal market system would actually require more elaborate institutional apparatus. Chapters 3 and 5 return to this proposition in greater detail, but one possible synthesis would hinge on differentiating between two different meanings of more governed. LMEs may require more governance in the limited sense of more laws and regulations to support markets, but with respect to the private side of governance, such as business practices or social norms, it may make more sense to simply conclude that all markets are governed and to leave it at that. 9. A coordinated market economy like Japan requires more governance, not less, to shift toward the liberal market model. This proposition follows logically from propositions 3 and 8. Chapter 4 examines this proposition at length, demonstrating that Japanese leaders publicly vowed to shift in the direction of a more liberal market system beginning in the 1990s. But to do so, they had to enact a daunting array of legal and regulatory reforms, and to launch campaigns to alter business practices and embrace market values. And despite all of this effort, Japan still did not converge on the liberal market model. 10. The information revolution requires more market governance, not less. Advances in information technology, IT, have dramatically reduced the cost and increased the speed of many market transactions. Yet technology has also created new challenges of market design that defy the government versus market dichotomy. The information economy requires more governance because the core commodity, information, is itself the product of rules, such as patent and copyright protection. So governance becomes more essential to economic performance and also more complex. IT markets also rely heavily on sectors where regulation is essential, such as telecommunications and finance. The information revolution enables the fabrication of sophisticated markets, such as complex auctions or financial derivatives markets, which in turn rely on more intricate market governance. And the information economy poses new challenges for antitrust enforcement, discussed further in chapters 2 and 3. Some of these propositions, 1 through 7, follow logically, whereas others, 8 through 10, will require more empirical evidence for support. The next three chapters review the evidence, but first, let us address the critical question of whether governments must govern markets and define a few key terms. Market governance. We have established that markets require governance. But does that mean that governments have to do the governing? Governments have been the central actors in the three transformations noted in the preceding sections: the historical evolution of the market system in the West, the transition from command to market economies in Eastern Europe and East Asia, and the construction of market institutions in developing countries today. Governments play the central role in market governance because they have the unique ability to create and enforce laws and regulations over a given territory. Ronald Coase argues, in his seminal article on The Problem of Social Cost, that private actors could resolve problems of market governance on their own via private settlements if there were no transaction costs. This essay motivated some market liberals to deploy the Coase theorem to argue that private contracts could replace government regulation in various arenas. In practical terms, however, governments have to establish the property rights system that undergirds private settlements. Governments also have greater administrative and financial capabilities than private sector actors, and they tend to be more neutral, legitimate, and accountable. David Moss argues that governments have several critical attributes when it comes to risk management. For example, the ability to compel participation, a near-perfect credit rating based on the power to tax and print money, and unparalleled monitoring capabilities rooted in regulatory and enforcement powers. Yet governments certainly do not govern markets alone. They sometimes delegate regulation to private sector self-regulatory organizations and standard-setting bodies. A wide range of private sector organizations contribute to market governance, from industry associations to trade unions. The relationships among private sector actors, such as management labor relations, bank industry relations, supply chains, and distribution networks, also structure markets. Private sector practices govern markets, from vocational training systems to research and development consortia. And, of course, societal norms powerfully condition market behavior. In order to study market governance, therefore, we have to examine both government and private sector governance, and the interaction between the two. Thus, I favor the term governance rather than regulation because the latter tends to refer more exclusively to government regulation. I define governance as follows, following Mark Bever. Governance refers to all processes of governing, whether undertaken by a government, market, or network, whether over a family, tribe, corporation, or territory, and whether by laws, norms, power, or language. Governance is a broader term than government because it focuses not only on the state and its institutions, but also on the creation of rule and order in social practices. Bringing private governance into the analysis is critical for making sense of several of the key propositions in the preceding section. For example, there is no free market, Proposition 1, and the government versus markets dichotomy is misleading, Proposition 6, in part because if we were able to eliminate the laws and regulations that govern markets, this would leave the private governance of markets in place. And the regulation versus competition dichotomy is misleading, Proposition 7, because even if we were able to eliminate anti-competitive laws and regulations, this would leave private anti-competitive practices intact. Market liberals would contend that government regulation is nonetheless more problematic than private governance, not only because it is more threatening to personal liberty, but also because it is more vulnerable to capture by special interests seeking to game the system for their own benefit. These interests may seek to influence regulation to earn rents, in the terminology of political economy, meaning unearned income or returns above market value. But if markets are always governed, and market governance includes both government regulation and private sector practices, then it follows that private firms can seek rents whether or not the government acts. Private firms may seek monopoly profits by anti-competitive behavior in the marketplace as well as by lobbying government to favor them. In fact, they may be freer to seek rents in the absence of government regulation. To be clear, I am not arguing that government regulation is not vulnerable to capture. Chapters 2 through 4 will provide many examples of regulatory capture. But I contend that capture is a variable and not a constant, that public sector governance is no more conducive to rent-seeking than private governance, that government failure to act can foster rent-seeking just as much as government action, and that effective government regulation can limit it. Let me now turn to defining market and market development before presenting a simple typology of market governance. The market can refer to an abstraction, the proverbial perfect market, or to a concrete real-world market, a place of exchange such as a farmer's market, or a product market such as the automobile market. A perfect market would have many buyers and sellers, comparable products, complete information, no enforcement costs, and supply and demand would determine prices. This volume focuses on real-world markets, not perfect markets. So it defines markets simply as arenas in which buyers and sellers come together to exchange goods and/or services. To move beyond the perfect market ideal to study real-world market institutions, we need to conceive of market development in a way that does not rely exclusively on
sample complete. Ready to continue?